Oh, yeah, the recent, yeah.
Oh, well, that's some sort of interesting things. Okay, so I was going to sort of provide a quasi review of Sam Harris's Immoral Landscape. Has anybody read it?
No.
When was this written?
That's a good question. When was it written?
Maybe we should start out there.
Copyright 2010. So. He does discuss, among other things, the Taliban, but he also discusses other groups of semi-recent history. This book, by the way, is sort of an extension of what he originally did for his PhD thesis. So there's some neuroscience in the book and some of his other ideals in the books. He starts with delineating what he sees as the two forms of morality. One, the dogmatic religious, comes from God, and the other what he calls moral relativity. He seems to define this as morality being thought to be variable, coming from where you are culturally. His argument against this is twofold. One, that this leads to essentially an overdose of tolerance, and provides an example of a discussion he had. And two, that a better way to deal with the topic is to define morality as values deriving from increasing / decreasing well-being of the individual / society, and then applying that definition to his chosen field, neuroscience, so that you can study morality scientifically and come up with better ideas on how to deal with it. For example, one of his basic choices is the wearing of the burqa as basically nonsensical. And I sort of had to agree with that kind of point of view. All the justifications for the burqa I have read pretty much come out to say, we men are really weak-willed individuals, so you women have to protect us so we won't have bad ideas in our brains and get distracted. And if you consider that from the well-being, I mean, that also leads basically into the she deserved it, if you ever you know, read the sort of rape excuse arguments. So if you consider that from the question of the well-being of the individual, it doesn't really work. Let's see if I can find the argument that he, the discussion that he had with one of the scholars. What makes you think that science will ever be able to say that forcing women to wear burqas is wrong? Me, Harris, because I think that right and wrong are a matter of increasing or decreasing well-being, and it is obvious that forcing half the population to live in cloth bags and beating or killing them if they refuse is not a good strategy for maximizing well-being. She, but that's only your opinion. Harris, okay, let's make it even simpler. What if we found a culture that ritually blinded every third child by literally plucking out his or her eyes at birth? Would you then agree that we had found a culture that was needlessly diminishing human well-being? She, it would depend on why they were doing it. Me, slowly returning my eyebrows from the back of my head. Let's say they were doing it on the basis of religious superstition. In their scripture, God says every third must walk in darkness. She, then you could never say they were wrong.
Oh, what?
Wow.
And
it sounds like a
conversation.
Yeah. Was that a real conversation?
Very much so. Yeah, he reports it as a real conversation, and he's also reports that it's not uncommon in the ivory tower. No, but he could probably figure out who he's talking about, because he says this person has been appointed to the President's Commission for the Study of Bioethical Issues and is now only one of only 13 people who will advise President Obama on, quote, issues that may emerge from advances in biomedicine and related areas of science and technology, unquote.
I think Norm Frost is on that.
So what I would be wondering about is, you know, what were her goals behind how she was answering, what was the actual topic in the discussion? Because it could be, I could imagine that she might be disagreeing with the concept of dividing things into right and wrong. In other words, she may be trying to get away from dealing with things in terms of a judging viewpoint.
Well, his preliminary thing says that he cited the ruthless misogyny and religious bamboozlement of the Taliban as an example of a worldview that seems less than perfectly conducive to human flourishing. And apparently that got everybody excited.
Everybody.
At the meeting.
What was the meeting?
And with that, you could say, you know, you could rationally say it seems like it is less than conducive for that, but then I think some people have a real hard time going then saying, well, this is right and this is wrong. Mm-hmm. We can say that I wish, you know, in other words, when you take, and that goes back to having a standard of God says this is right and this is wrong, instead you could say, this is not what I want in the world, and what I want to bring about and live my life for is our conditions that are flourishing, and so this is not something that fits with what I want or want to influence.
But is he saying right and wrong? I think you said he was saying that.
I think that's what he's trying to avoid, the right and the wrong. He's trying to avoid that by going to increasing well-being and then decreasing well-being.
Yeah, but your well-being and mine might not be the same.
Well,
he also sort of discusses that. He has a whole basically chapter where he presents a definition of a good life, you know, earn a lot of money, have a nice house, do charity work, that sort of stuff, and a bad life where you witness your daughter being gang raped and dismembered and you running through the steaming jungle trying to escape the soldiers. And then he, you know, he says that it's still a good life and a bad life, because if you go with the sort of the theory that, you know, the person with all the trauma is going to end up being such a good person they'll end up in heaven afterwards, then that's the better life, then that's technically the good life and not the bad life. So you could just sort of switch the terms around whichever way you want to go. So he sort of does cover that, and that's sort of why he's sort of switching the morality argument from the increasing well-being and decreasing well-being. And yes, you can argue which one is better there as well. It makes an interesting argument. For example, one of the arguments he uses is that, I just found this an interesting argument. He uses the argument that if there was only one case of female child genitalia removal, then the uproar would be fantastic, because you are technically abusing this child. But if it is done repeatedly in a different culture, the tendency is to regard that action as sacrosanct to their culture, and that happens in way too many cases, and that's not necessarily going to still be good for the kid. It's just what happens in the culture, so nobody can touch it, basically. So if you were to take morality as being increasing well-being, you're not increasing the well-being of even in that culture, even if that's what they're supposed to do it.
But there's the belief behind that when that's done that they are. And even the, I mean, not universally, but beliefs, the idea that whenever people do things, they're doing them for good reasons behind it. In other words, if my child does not have her genitalia removed, those part of it, she won't find a good husband. She won't fit into society. She won't grow up to be what we think is a good woman's.
But that's very false reasoning, because the old women now talk that way in these countries where they have genital mutilation. But it started somewhere done by men who gave this phony argument about, you know, women need to wear burqas and they can't do this and that, because the poor guys are so susceptible to sexual drives overpowering everything else. And it's a power structure that started those things. And the women bought into this false reasoning, this non-logic, which is what it is. And especially the old ones. And right now, I was in the Senegal and talked with a number of young professional women who are getting better educations now, and they would not, you know, they wouldn't hide their hair and stuff, and they were talking, it takes a long time to get rid of these false logics that were created by the power structure, which was males in the old day. You know, so the whole thing is just false.
I think another thing he's trying to get at is that by protecting people's behavior based on their culture, you're giving them the ability to continue with anti-humanist behavior. And they get a shield, they get an automatic pass from any kind of criticism.
Yeah.
And then it can spill over the opposite way to where you automatically not only don't criticize them, but you come to their defense when they're doing these horrible things as a knee-jerk reaction.
I ran into this with a lot of young colleagues when I was living in Germany in the 60s and 70s and early 80s. And they did exactly that. They were so politically, the younger people, were so politically correct that they went overboard in the wrong direction. For example, at that time, I did keep my mouth shut. I would never criticize Israel because of I grew up in Germany and in this horrible culture of the anti-Semitism. It was 12 years. That's a short time, but still it was so pervasive, and I was ashamed to say anything, even though I thought what they were doing to the people in Palestine was ethically, you know, totally ill, totally wrong. And it took me another couple of decades to finally learn to open my mouth in that, on topics like this. And I'm more in touch with some of the young Israelis now who are criticizing their own governments, you know, their own hard-nosed conservative government. And there are a lot of those, but they're not in power.
Well, it is a challenge when people see the world as either right or wrong, and then this is in opposition to that, that's kind of, you start triangulating until you can't tell which, you know.
Oh, yeah.
People get they want a simple answer.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah.
And it's, you know, I wonder too, I mean, like the Bible says, you know, you worry about somebody's eye when you've got a log in yours. I mean, we have some cultural things that need addressing, and maybe it's easier to work within your own culture rather than somebody else's. I mean, because when you watch these reality shows, you know, little kids and tiara things, you know, the beauty pageant that some people put their kids through, is that any better than?
Yes, it is.
Well,
the
genital, but it's not good. It's not good.
No, but I mean, it's better than
mutilation
or beheading people.
Or a death penalty for disbelief. Yeah.
Right. But I mean, I'm just. Yeah.
No, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
I think sometimes it's actually easier for Sam Harris to make an argument about something he assumes his readers will all agree.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes looking at another.
A straw man.
Let's not look at ourselves, because you're not going to be able to do that very well.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So maybe we'll look at, you know, some historical event that we have some distance from or something.
That probably goes into the sort of the next section of the book. He does have at least he started a thesis in the degree of neuroscience, so he does bring in some neuroscience studies and some other studies that have to do with the brain and how they deal with right and wrong or what's actual and what's not actual. And among other things, there was this interesting study that showed that activity in the brain's motor regions can be detected some 350 milliseconds before a person feels that he has decided to move.
Mm-hmm.
And a similar study to question the belief in moral responsibility and provides a set of scenarios all possible to demonstrate that most readers, that opinions on the degree of moral responsibility come from a morass of details. I don't know if that made any sense. Essentially, he provides five examples of basically a woman being murdered. And each example there's a degree where somebody would say he probably doesn't have that much responsibility for his actions. A five-year-old finds a gun in his parents' locker, and then you have a psychopath who doesn't know right or wrong and just goes out and kills somebody, you know, just because he wants to go kill somebody. And then somebody who was upset that his girlfriend left him. You argue that that sort of thing, he does have more responsibility there. So it, if you just say that X killed Y, you sort of automatically jump to the conclusion, you know, moral responsibility. But once you get into the morass of details, the level of moral responsibility will change to the person. So it really sort of, I mean, gosh, I'm probably not saying this well, but yeah, it really doesn't sort of say that. And it sort of argues that, well, his language is the illusion of free will is an illusion. I'm going to read his paragraph here. It is generally agreed that our sense of free will presents a compelling mystery. On the one hand, it is impossible to make sense of it in casual terms. On the other, there is a powerful subjective sense that we are the authors of our own actions. However, I think that this mystery is itself a symptom of our confusion. It is not that free will is simply an illusion. Our experience is not merely delivering a distorted view of reality. Rather, we are mistaken about the nature of our experience. We do not feel as free as we think we feel. Our own sense of freedom results from not paying attention to what is actually like to be what we are. The moment we do pay attention, we begin to see that free will is nowhere to be found, and our subjectivity is perfectly compatible with this truth. Thoughts and intentions simply arise in the mind. What else could they do? The truth about us is stranger than many suppose. The illusion of free will is itself an illusion.
I wonder if we might look at an example that was highlighted in two issues of our newspaper about the bombing of
Russia. Syria.
No,
Matt Stein's building.
The Second World War.
The building in at Madison University.
Sterling Hall.
And there were five guys, five. And one of them has never been found again. He's still maybe dead, maybe not. Maybe he's just living somewhere. And the other four were found and put in prison for a while. But the question is, what they did was a moral action that's excusable? And you realize what was happening in those days was the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. It was in the middle of the Vietnam War. And they were using, spraying
Agent Orange
all over Vietnam and so on. And of course that was continuing until eventually the war was ended. But that was another 5-6 years after. And so those guys were very aware of what else was happening, that what else the United States was doing in the name of whatever, morality of some sort. I think that's a good example to think about.
I think it's a good example for the fact that none of this ethical question can be totally resolved. You always go back to certain circumstances and ideology. The Germans, I mean the new Germany after the Holocaust and after the total destruction almost of Germany, when they created their constitution, they tried to find the best from the French Revolution and what we in America used of the French Revolution and so forth. And they came up with one sentence that covers quite a bit, and I'm sure you can tear that apart too. And that one sentence is, it's a core sentence, and that's about as far as I can go. Die Würde des Menschen ist unantastbar, which means the dignity of a human is untouchable. I mean, that's a pretty good statement, but I'm sure you can poke holes in there too. I just don't believe it's totally possible. And just like I don't believe that you can come up with any religious dogma that's totally untouchable. You know, I don't have one anyway, I'm Unitarian. But, you know, but this idea of the human dignity, that means it is something that is untouchable, and that means also physically untouchable. That includes any kind of murder for any kind of reason, you know, so. I don't.
Well, I mean, there's also the question of hindsight. He provides an example of a group of, I forget whether it was psychologists or not, I think they were psychologists, who got themselves admitted to psychiatric hospitals, saying that they heard three words in their brain, like somebody was speaking three words into their brain, and they got themselves admitted. And they thought that once they said they didn't hear it anymore and they were saying they could get out pretty quickly. And instead, the majority of them were subjected to a whole bunch of trials, despite the fact that they were sane to begin with. A whole bunch of trials, and hardly any of them got out before like 45 to 90 days was the limit. However, when the hospitals learned about this, the hospitals got all upset. And one in particular got all upset, so they said they'd send a test subject down to this hospital. They didn't, but the hospital still found somebody because they were expecting it. So, you know, in hindsight, it's pretty bad. I mean, like Galen's example here, my own hindsight would say that given what happened and that the protests pretty much died down after the bombing, it wasn't really that effective. To produce the point.
Well, the ones that were caught made the statement that they had warned, they had sent out warnings that the place should be empty. And Fasnacht didn't get that message. He's the young guy who was in there doing his scholarly work. So they tried, but anyway, it's the sort of thing.
Yeah, but even so, I mean, in hindsight, it did sort of kill the protests, the protests could have been more effective otherwise.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But as far as the mental hospital is concerned, probably the reason those people didn't get out right away is mental patients are really good at lying.
Oh, yeah.
And they will say, oh, yeah, I don't hear it anymore. And I know because I have an uncle who has schizophrenia, and he was been very, very good about pretending he's better and fooling psychiatrists.
Oh, really?
So that's probably has a lot to do with that.
The skepticism of the...
Yeah, because they know that...
Yeah. He might be fooling himself.
Yeah.
The police are like that too. I mean, all day long they deal with people who are not telling them the truth, and a lot of times people are, and they say, well, I've heard it before.
Yeah.
And they don't, you know, they can be overly skeptical. I'm curious about what he's saying about free will being an illusion. That always seems so
counterintuitive.
Right, there have been several studies that have come to that conclusion.
Well, if you had true free will, I mean, if there were no drivers in your life, you'd almost be frozen about what to do next.
Yeah.
You know?
That's where emotion comes in. That's the driver to get you to make decisions.
Yeah.
So how does that relate to what you're saying about morality? Just that people aren't really free to make choices, or we shouldn't judge the morality because we don't know it's his
neuroscience argument against the argument about the right and the wrong versus thing. So that's just a sort of neuroscience object. There's not really a right and a wrong because you're thinking about it beforehand. Anyway.
So don't oversimplify.
Mm-hmm.
Because there can be factors. If
the action potential is there in your brain milliseconds before you actually decide to do it,
mm-hmm.
then you've already made the decision before you make the decision. So
right, it's like a post hoc rationalization.
But then there'd be two layers in the case of a 5-year-old who finds a gun and accidentally kills the woman. No one would say that was a good outcome. It's more the question of was there a motive or
intent.
Yeah. So there's two parts to it. What happened is horrible. Nobody disagrees with that. But we're always really more interested in the motive, right?
Yeah, but most of the time, then, you know, I mean, if it's a 5-year-old kid, they almost throw out the moral responsibility out the door. Skip the idea of good and evil. They sort of say, I mean, they blame the parent for giving the gun in the house, but.
Yeah, but I mean, aren't there those people that are medically psychopathic and that really, you know, they can't function? And that's why we have in our constitution, they could not get the death penalty because they are sick. And I'm learning a lot about drug abuse right now because my granddaughter, unfortunately, got sucked into this epidemic. And I'm with the non-anon people learning, you know, that those are people who just lie beautifully. Like my granddaughter, that is just a horrible thing. And that's where free will is medically not possible. I mean, you know, and what do you do with those people? I mean, it's really difficult.
Oh,
but I mean, I'll give you another example. This kid that was sent up in an airplane, I think a 9-year-old kid, the parents let the kid fly an airplane, and of course she got killed. And I think those parents were not medically certified psychopaths. They were people, wrong-headed people. I mean, I would heavily punish those parents, you know, for doing this to a 9-year-old kid. That's a difference, isn't there?
Another example was the kid who accidentally killed his brother when they were out hunting.
Oh yeah,
when
they have guns around the house. Sure.
Yeah, he was, how old was that kid, do you remember? He was preteen, I think. Mm-hmm. And, but he was given a gun to go ahead and hunt. For a year, I guess, along with the adults, and he had the gun in hand, and he pulled the trigger accidentally, I guess, and killed his brother. And so,
was he aware that the brother was in front of the gun?
Yeah, he was right there.
His last name wasn't Cheney by any chance.
He actually, I mean, Sam Harris actually does acknowledge that your argument about psychopaths, and he does have a section in the same chapter with the free will and moral responsibility argument.
Yeah.
He points out that the first neuroimaging study done on psychopaths demonstrated that they exhibit, what is this the quote here, significantly less activity in regions of the brain that generally respond to emotional stimuli.
Yeah, and I mean, that's been researched fairly recently.
Mm-hmm.
They're still working on this sort of thing. And they're finding out a lot of really medical things.
Mm-hmm. So hopefully, like some of the cases I met in Total Mental Health Institute, they can figure out who needs care all the time.
But what do you do with the people, you know, that for religious reasons don't allow treatment of their seriously ill children? It's just the wrong ideology that they're doing, but they're doing it willingly because they believe something that's totally screwy.
They think they're doing the right thing.
Oh, I know. See, they think it.
They would
but what do you do with that sort of thing? You know? And that's where I think the argument comes in, the dignity and that means all the healthiness and stuff of the human being is unantastable, is inviolable. And that's why I think a little bit of this statement in the German Constitution would help, because the inviolability of the child would take precedence over any learned religion or ideology.
Well, I think the government hesitates, and everyone probably, I have to hesitate to criticize any parenting practice because it's seen as an intrusion on privacy.
Yeah.
And frankly, parents are given a kind of property rights over their children. And you don't tell me what I can and can't do kind of thing.
But if it touches the health and well-being or even the life of the child. The living person.
What do we do with the football player? It's one of those takes a switch to his leg.
Yeah.
But it's one of those conversations that if you don't we don't talk about it very often, and when we do, it's to get all up in arms and angry at the football player because that clearly crossed the line. It has to get to that point before we say, do we have a right to expect certain things, and how far can we go?
And
telling
that's why
parents how to, you know, at what point is it too much to tell parents how to discipline children?
Well, if you have an election since amateur boxing was eliminated from the U.S. And it kind of looks like they're trying with the education and the football, but they haven't got the public to pass up this Saturday afternoon games. Other than that, they're about ready to do something because of the unacceptable number of brain injuries. And it's the same problem as amateur boxing.
It's interesting that in our culture, probably the sacrosanct thing that we do that damages our children the most is probably suit them up for football. You know, and you can't criticize that. That's, you know, like a religion in the United States.
But you can criticize, and some people do criticize. And I know that the older I get, the more loudly I criticize these sacred cows.
It's because the more immune you are, the older you are.
Yeah.
to repercussions.
Sure.
Economic or social. Yeah, you are much more immune than I am.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was your age, I would probably be a lot more vocal,
too. He's got an employer.
Right.
Oh.
So,
But I mean, I always am really, I admire very much the young people who do speak up. And I think when I immigrated into this country, I thought, gee, it was great, you know, after living in Nazi Germany, and great country, free country. And little by little, I realized that here the people are more prone to keep their mouth shut because you have to keep smiling and be nice to everybody. And so I don't go along with that. Yeah. And when I came back from a long time in Germany for doing the research for my dissertation to get my doctorate, some of my closest friends here said to me, hey, you have changed a little bit, haven't you? You're a little bit more, you know, rabid about your opinion. And I realized that, yeah. Because, you know, over there, I got together with different ages and different of the new, quote-unquote, new Germans. This is a new Germany. So I thought, my God, they're getting at each other in debates and discussions. They're probably ending their friendship. But they didn't. They just spoke out clearly. And then I met a couple of African-Americans. And a good friend of mine, who unfortunately died, who was married to a German, a white German teacher. And we talked a lot about, you know, race issues and so forth. And he became a German citizen. And he thought he was more comfortable with the German racism, and there is, of course, that, than with the American because it was more open. And, I'm not so afraid to step on anybody's toes. That, I think that's the point.
Well, I'm at the end of the book, he's Sam Harris, so he can't resist himself, probably. He also brings up the danger of morality in terms of the religion aspects. In his case, he brings up, and I didn't know this, a Francis Collins, who was appointed the executive director of the National Institute for Health, and is also even an evangelical Christian.
Yeah.
And he wrote a book, The Language of God, which purports to set up a harmony between religion and 21st century science. One of the, I'm going to do two quotes here. One of them is a hoax, and one of them is one of his favorite writers. See if you can tell which one is which. If we regard human beings as psychosomatic unities, as I believe both the Bible and contemporary experience of the intimate connection between mind and brain encourage us to do, then the soul will have to be understood in an Aristotelian sense as the form or information-bearing pattern of the body. Though this pattern is dissolved at death, it seems perfectly rational to believe that it will be remembered by God and reconstituted in a divine act of resurrection. The matter of the world to come, which will be the carrier of the re-embodiment, will be transformed matter of the present universe, itself redeemed by God beyond its cosmic death. The resurrected universe is not a second attempt by the Creator to produce a world ex nihilo, but it is the transmutation of the present world in an act of new creation ex veteri.
What was that last word?
Ex veteri.
What does that mean?
Yeah, I don't know.
Good question. Latin.
Oh,
E-X-V-E-T-E-R-E.
Outside the window. I don't know.
And here we go for the second quote. The discourse of the scientific community, for all its undeniable value, cannot assert a privileged epistemological status with respect to counter-hegemonic narratives emanating from dissident or marginalized communities. In quantum gravity, as we shall see, the space-time manifold ceases to exist as an objective physical reality. Geometry becomes relational and contextual, and the foundational conceptual categories of prior science, among them existence itself, become problematized and relativized. The conceptual revolution, I will argue, has profound implications for the content of a future postmodern and liberatory science.
What?
I think people have too much time on their hands.
The first quote is Francis Collins, and the second quote is garbage.
Oh.
The first one is rational by that Christian point of view.
Oh yeah.
That's my opinion.
It's actually written by a physicist, Andrew Sokol, sort of. It's a nonsense paper he wrote. It's called Transgressing the Boundaries Towards a Transformative Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity.
That's the second one.
And while the paper was patently insane, the journal, which still stands at the forefront of cultural theory, avidly published it.
Yeah.
Well,
the second guy might have been thinking something stupid to see how hard they accepted.
That's exactly what he was doing.
That's exactly what he was doing, yeah. On the other hand, I mean, they use the language, but they still don't understand it. Francis Collins has said that even if all his plausible reasons for the existence of God proved to be wrong, he's still going to believe no matter what.
Well,
that's
okay.
Yes, we will do that.
There's something pertinent in psychedelic research to what she just said. And that is when they give LSD and similar drugs to volunteers, they warn them that they're going to have a very convincing religious experience, but it happens frequently enough to be taken in.
Mm-hmm.
And the typical result is that the vast majority of these people say yes, but mine was different. It was legal.
That's what Sam Harris's next book is about, I think. I heard him on a podcast describing that subject yesterday.
And what I got out of that was that almost all of these religions, like Mormonism and arise in a person who doesn't even need psychedelic drugs because he has temporal lobe epilepsy.
Well, he quotes two studies in terms of religion. One study was just about belief. I believe eagles are true, for example, something like that. And whether they're religious or non-religious, the brain activity was the same for that. But once they got to the religious brain things, they noticed that both the pain and the reward centers were more stimulated in the religious person than the non-religious person. Whether this constitutes an argument for morality or of religion actually being a good idea and effective is a question that he sort of leaves open. He basically says no.
But he doesn't say anything about watch out for temporal lobe epilepsy.
Oh, no. No, no, no. He doesn't go into drugs in this book. No, no, no. He does go into several examples of Collins' Language of God, where he points out that everything Collins says is an affirmation of whatever God says he's going to have to do. It's perfectly natural.
Well, as a sophomore in high school, my spare time project was reading forbidden books to make up my own mind. And I backed into a kind of a lab course in reading sacred textbooks critically. Mm-hmm. The most notable one was the Book of Mormon, which I put aside after just a few pages because the description of the golden tablets was so complete, with such emphasis that it was pure gold, that you could calculate on the back of an envelope that the golden tablets were 1,200 pounds each.
He stuck it in his back pocket and carried another one.
So that was the end of that. Even if it was temporal lobe epilepsy, doesn't alter the fact that they were describing 1,200 pounds of gold.
You didn't give anyone a chance to tell you it was just a metaphor.
Well, as a matter of fact,
or color.
I got some librarians to look up various editions of the Book of Mormon. Apparently, this problem was discovered a whole bunch of times by a whole bunch of people.
They decided to revise the books.
And there were so many revisions, it was totally stupid. You'd think that they'd gotten a committee together to come up with the official revision. Mm-hmm. And finally, the librarian seemed to be totally committed to looking for more and more editions to find the one that I read. And I told her I was guilty of arrogant complacency. And she didn't need to look anymore. Subsequently, I found out that Buddhists have a better word for arrogant complacency. And that's willful ignorance.
We had a very good friend who was a Mormon. Mormon botanist, and I lived in Arizona, and we got to know him pretty well. But he said the concrete that was used to build the Mormon temple had more tobacco spit in it than it did concrete. And tobacco was completely forbidden by the Book of Mormon at that time. That was his, and the only reason that he remained a Mormon was that one of his children was born with a very, I'm not sure, it was some sort of a birth defect, so that he couldn't really take care of himself. And the Mormon Church takes care of people like that, who are born into that church. They take care of them 100%.
Yeah.
No, no questions asked. So the family is more or less forced to remain in Mormon Church.
So how moral is that?
Yeah.
Well, what do they do about
stay
people becoming Mormons?
You don't believe
it. He's one of the
most.
He's one of the most moral
people I ever knew.
With his father.
A lot of people didn't quit their jobs so they could have health insurance.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know.
It's a form of indentured
servitude.
Yeah.
Stick with what you definitely. Got. That's why I married him, really, was for the health insurance,
yes,
right?
I even had another. I had a colleague down in Whitewater who were taught. Who was a Mormon, and he was only temporarily at Whitewater. He left for another job, and his wife was living in Fort Atkinson nearby with their children, several children. And his attitude was, well, I'm just leaving. I'm going to live wherever he's went, I don't know where he went, somewhere else in the United States for another job. And he said the Mormon Church is going to
take care of
it.
Yeah.
My family. That was, I talked to him. And that's
well, how long did you have to be a Mormon before you would see Vince Burke?
I don't know. Long enough to have a family, I guess, and several kids. And added numbers to the Mormon.
Well, if Scott Walker was a Mormon, he'd have to have a drug test to get these benefits.
Yeah, anyway, well, we could talk about the Mormons for a long time.
Well, speaking of arguments, when Sam Harris criticized the appointment, he basically got slammed with the... He's arguing against him because Collins is a Christian and not going with any of his real arguments on why he's not a good pick.
Referring to Collins.
Mm-hmm.
Who?
Mm-hmm. I said, when Sam Harris criticized the appointment of Collins, the evangelical Christian, he basically got it because he was prejudiced against religion instead of any of the good arguments. Mm-hmm. And to be fair to Collins, and he is fair to Collins, and does state that he's willing to do more embryonic stem cell research than the average evangelical Christian would support, for example.
Mm-hmm.
However, I mean, he does also point out, though, that you can't help digging into these things, this person, evangelical Christian, is lauded because he actually says he believes in evolution. Which for scientists, that's sort of, you know, I mean,
that's like a
leaning over backwards to say nice things about this guy.
Believes in gravity.
Yeah.
Good.
But, I mean, the way he sort of argues the point against the religion here is he brings up Carlin's arguments and pretty much shows that there's really holes in it. Morality comes from God to humans. He points out several cases where they've seen moral behavior in chimps, mice, dogs,
dolphins.
Studies of dolphins, mm-hmm. Yeah. And,
well, God could have made them moral.
Collins is saying that the moral law comes from God to humans. His quote, the quote that Heron says about Collins is, while other animals may at times appear to show glimmerings of moral sense, they are certainly not widespread, and in many instances, other species' behavior seems to be in dramatic contrast to any sense of universal rightness. And see, religious again uses the rightness term here.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
But
so.
Okay.
No, go ahead.
In the animal kingdom, you know, what may appear not right might be good for the overall species. Yeah.
You know,
if the tomcat comes around and kills the young, maybe that's better.
Well, there's certainly a sense of fair play present in primates. They've done numerous studies to prove that that's the case. And he even mentions the mice experiment, which I thought was not that old.
2010.
Yeah, I thought that was more like a couple of years ago, but they've found that mice have compassion for each other and have...
I don't mean companion animals, I mean...
Mm-hmm.
Any number of instances, I think everybody's experienced
I think it's more of a mammalian thing than anything else. I think it's pretty much all mammals.
Yeah.
Maybe some birds.
Something to do with having to nurse the baby.
And it's another one was more another one more of a dig than an argument, though still an argument, is that you can use the miracles, such as the miracle of virgin birth, and he points out that at the time Genghis Khan was thought to have a virgin birth, which is not one of your turn the other cheek type of dudes, shall we put it that way.
So that's
a real problem with the Bible when it makes such a thing about Jesus being descended from King David, but the immaculate conception knocks that whole sequence into a cocked hat.
Yeah.
Well, that's where my skepticism started.
So, yeah, and
Jesus has two dads. Come on.
My two dads.
But didn't they know that your Jewishness comes from your mother and not from your dad?
Right.
There's a lot of inconsistencies. And how about God sponsoring genocide in order to get the Holy Land?
You're talking preaching to the converted.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to know if you read any criticism of the book or have any people had issues with it that you know about or with his thesis?
I expect they would, but I didn't have the time, to be quite honest.
This book, it was on my mind this week because Friday night on HBO, he was the guest on Bill Maher's show. Mm. And we watched him. Usually the special guest comes down and gets to talk about whatever he wants to talk about while the panel quietly listens, and then they have a conversation. And I don't know if he got two sentences into his thoughts about Islam before Ben Affleck, the movie star, just lost it and started yelling at him and calling him a racist and saying you're sick and you're gross.
Oh my God.
It was just unhinged, and I was really disappointed because I was looking forward to hearing what he had to say, and it just turned into a shouting match with Bill Maher shouting and everybody saying stupid things. And
Sam Harris was very patient. It was amazing. He kept trying to say his piece, but
was trying to have a complex conversation with. You know, a little more detail, like you were talking about. It's not simple, and you could tell that was not the way Ben Affleck liked it. So
was there quite a bit of conflict in the audience among themselves?
It really came down to not being able to separate religion from people, and so they said, "You're being a racist by criticizing the tenets of Islam." And he says, "No, I'm not. I'm talking about ideas, not people." And I just didn't want to hear it.
Well, he also started off by saying that there is a tendency for a lot of people to have a knee-jerk reaction in defense of Islam without being able to criticize it at all for anything and to immediately assume that you're being biased. And then Affleck immediately goes to demonstrate exactly what he's talking about.
I'm glad you read this book, Susan.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, yes.
So that's a little bit of a recommendation to those of us who might be thinking about it.
But why was she glad? Did she really need it?
Well, did it give you some ammunition?
Well, actually, it's better for what I was actually doing here, which actually succeeded, which is causing conversation, because he does produce an awful lot of questions for people to think about.
Yeah.
And it's almost one of his goals, because if you skip to the end, and by the way, if you do read this book, read the footnotes. The footnotes are just about as good as the book.
That's true. Some books.
Final conclusion.
I think this pretty. I mean, it's comes to a conclusion, but in my mind, it puts as about many questions it is. This is the last paragraph of the book. If our well-being depends upon the interaction between events in our brains and events in the world, and there are better or worse ways to secure it, then some cultures will tend to produce lives that are more worth living than others. Some political persuasions will be more enlightened than others, and some worldviews will be mistaken in ways that cause needless human misery. Whether or not we ever understand meaning, morality, and values in practice, I have attempted to show that there must be something to know about them in principle. And I am convinced that merely admitting this will transform the way we think about human happiness and the public good. Which is a nice paragraph, mm-hmm. but it leaves you totally open to all sorts of questions and thoughts and everything else. So, I mean, that's almost the tenor of the whole book. Well, except for that where he's picking on Collins.
What's the name of the country in Central Asia?
Bhutan,
yeah. That is all for happiness.
Gross national happiness.
Gross national happiness. Yeah, I did a Google search the other day just to find out what it was saying about Bhutan, and it didn't have a single word. And in many, many paragraphs about that happiness is being. I've forgotten what. That is that sort of an official statement of
even facetious stuff can't be good for that. Decades ago, I read a new facetious piece that stated that overemphasis on athletics is the military equivalent of masturbation. And it suppresses inappropriate military desires. Now that's some food for thought, isn't it?
Thank you.
Okay, I thought that
might be. If you type in humanism data matters, you will see what's coming up with your see what's coming up.
It has all the vowels and the alphabet and the order.
Yeah, and prayers too.
P-E-I-O-U are all in positions of the order alphabet.
If you just Google prayers, you can see our upcoming
program. I came up with another word, so it's not unique. Abstinence has A-E-I-O-U in the other words.
I
would think it would be
this place was forever. Standing room
only. Yeah, you can help me with the I have for the other crossword puzzle, which is made entirely of angry words. So we have a double crossword puzzle.
Goes in that a little in this book, there is that problem with neuroscience.
Somebody pounded him for that and by the end.